focusing on educating people in unions, people in all sectors of the economy, women's organizations, youth organizations, and most aggressively for them, focusing on their parliamentarians to get them to resist this law, but also with international support. So the Iraqis were supported in educational and protest efforts by activists in Britain and activists in the United States, raising awareness in both countries with their own legislators, putting pressure on the U.S. and British governments not to put as much pressure on the Iraqis. And essentially, this organizing and the awareness that the oil law is essentially about not something bright and shiny and good for Iraq, but rather turning over Iraq's oil to foreign oil companies has succeeded in blocking the law. So it's actually a thus far a success story on, mm-hmm. on local and international organizing working to really successfully head off what I would say is still at this point the primary objective of the ongoing war in Iraq.
Well, meanwhile, China has signed some oil deal. Isn't that true?
Well, there's been a lot of back and forth. So what mm-hmm. is interesting unfolding is to see how the al-Maliki government, which still to this day, you know, essentially sees its future essentially tied to the continued occupation. This isn't mm-hmm. a popularly elected government. So it continues to see the occupation continue and tries to work with the Bush administration and the oil companies while at the same time trying not to, well, overly piss off its population.
Mm-hmm.
So the oil ministry has been trying to make deals with U.S. oil companies, but essentially not going far enough, not giving the oil companies what they want, which is the ownership of the oil. But other deals have been going forward, but none successfully. The China deal is a pre-existing contract that Saddam Hussein had signed with China, a Chinese oil company, which has essentially been on and off since the invasion began. Essentially, you know, right now we're winning the war of media attention, the war of the spotlight, which is that none of these deals are able to rise to a point where they're not scrutinized very, very well by the global population. Mm. And, you know, unless there are deals that are on the up and up, they're just not going through.
Yeah, an Iraqi friend of mine, he says that Mr. Shahristani, the oil minister, is a pretty honest guy, but I wonder just how effective he is. You know?
Uh-huh.
But I suppose this whole thing is up in the air for now, so let's get on to your book, The Tyranny of Oil. Tell us briefly about that. It's a big, thick book. I guess they have a lot of crimes to answer for, don't they?
Well, really? So my new book, which comes out now in less than a week, mm-hmm. Comes out on October the 7th, is The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, is the full title.
Mm-hmm.
And really clearly, this book follows very, very naturally off of the last. My last book was The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time.
Right.
Where I looked at the broader corporate influences on the Bush, on and within the Bush administration, and particularly how that led to and affected the invasion of Iraq, and clearly that work made it more and more clear to me that I needed to focus more exclusively on the oil industry. And when I started doing that work, I soon found out that essentially there had not been a comprehensive analysis of big oil. Really, in about 30 years since The Seven Sisters, a really classic book, came out in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have felt is that while we have grown so astute in our analysis and discussions of climate change, of peak oil, the geopolitics of oil, looking at war and so forth, the oil companies themselves have largely gotten off the hook. And we haven't been looking at who these companies are, what they want, how they're trying to get it, and what we need to do to essentially head them off before they carry us into greater climate change, more wars for oil, and really an erosion of our democracy. And that's why I wrote the book. That's why it ended up being so big, but also why I'm just extremely excited to be hitting the road talking about it. Obviously, oil and energy becoming such a critical part of this year's elections.
And but did you say, am I right in thinking that it's one big oil company?
Well, yes and no. You know, one of the things I look at is the historical development from Standard Oil to the oil companies of today, and we have seen really just a ridiculous process. When we look at this, you know, the finally, the buzzword all over the United States today is the fallacy of deregulation, or the fallacy is the wrong word, the horrific impacts of deregulation on our economy and on our world. And one of the areas of extreme deregulation that began in the 80s, but proceeded through the Clinton and Bush administrations, was deregulation of our antitrust laws. And we have allowed these enormous mergers to take place, such that we've created the largest companies in the history of the world, with Exxon merging with Mobil, with Chevron buying first Gulf Oil, then Texaco, then Unocal to become today's Chevron, Conoco merging with Phillips, BP buying Amoco and Arco, Shell buying many other oil pieces to create these behemoths that we have. But, you know, they could get larger, and they would like to. And, you know, we're at this key moment where the oil industry is more powerful financially than any industry has ever been in the history of the world, at the same time as it's sitting at this peak of its existence. The resource on which it depends is going to run out. And the oil industry is trying to do absolutely everything in its power to consolidate, to grow bigger, to grow more powerful, so that it can ensure that we, the public, do not deny it access to every single last drop available on the planet.
Well, we keep hearing that, you know, that the bulk of the oil trade now is you have the rise of these national oil companies, and I keep hearing that, well, the private companies are losing ground. How true is that?
Well, it just depends on what you're looking at. So what I'm looking at is ultimately the political influence of these companies. And that has everything to do with how much profit they've got sitting in the bank, because that's the extra cash they use to do things like try and convince us that drilling offshore is the best thing that's ever happened in the history of the world, or drilling for shale in the Midwest, or going after the tar sands in Canada, or buying an election and convincing us that Sarah Palin, who doesn't seem to have any discernible reason to be the vice presidential candidate, but is all about oil, is the right vice presidential candidate. And that's what this money is used for. These companies don't own as much oil as they used to. The private oil companies, the public oil companies as opposed to the government-owned oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, et cetera, used to own all of the world's oil. Today they only own about 13% of the world's oil. But they do phenomenal things with that power and with that control of that oil. And also importantly, OPEC does not control as much oil as it used to either. And the other state oil companies, China, Russia, Venezuela, these states don't tend to work together in their decision-making. So you actually have a fairly disparate group of actors, which allows big oil's influence to still be felt quite strongly on the global market, even though they would like us to think that it is not.
Tell us about, now you've written about speculation driving the price of oil up. I don't know, can speculation drive it down also? How does speculation work?
Well, I don't think I can cover speculation in a minute, but, you know, sort of needless to say, the primary determinant on the price of oil today is speculation, and that is simply energy traders who are predicting where the price of oil is going to go in the future and actually driving the price of oil up so that they will make more money on mm-hmm. their sales in the future. And these traders work for big oil. They work for the banks. They used to work for Enron, a lot of them, and now they're using their skills in the oil industry. And this is a huge problem, looking at deregulation. But also, you know, again, going back to this issue of peak oil, this is a speculative bubble that's built on top of a reality, which is that there will be a point at some point in the future, and probably not too far away, that demand will exceed supply. So you've got an incredibly unique position for the world's really most critical resource, where speculation is driving the price further and further up. That bubble will burst,
mm-hmm.
but it's on top of a true reality of peak oil. So
right.
nobody really knows what the impact of
so
of
in the meantime, they're making out like the bandits they are.
Exactly.
I guess our time is up. It's really great talking to you. I wish we had more time. Maybe we can talk to you later when your book comes out. And
absolutely.
But thank you very much. We've been talking to Antonia Juhas, who is our latest book is The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. And there's more information on my website, tyrannyofoil.org. Thanks.
Oh, that's a new website then.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Okay.
And Richard Heinberg is coming right up. Oh, this is Sue Supriano. I'm so happy to be here on KBOO. And Richard Heinberg, are you there?
Hi, Sue.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Great. It's wonderful to have you on.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you could make it. And I want to let people know, if they don't already know about you, that you are the author of The Party's Over, letting people know about the decline of oil, and that you're one of the first people to speak up about it, and you've written a lot of other books since then. Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. Peace, and the latest is Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines. So we have so much to talk about, and I know that you travel all over the world giving speeches. And can you give a real quick definition of peak oil? Because we don't want to spend too much time on that, but just to make sure everybody knows we're on the same page.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's the moment in history when world oil production reaches its maximum and begins to decline. And we know that's going to happen because it happens to individual oil-producing countries like the United States, which reached peak oil back in 1970. And now, of course, we import two-thirds of the oil that we use. So it's happening to country after country. The North Sea oil is in decline now. Mexico's oil production is declining at, their biggest oil field is called Cantarell. It's the third largest oil field in the world, and it's declining at a rate of about 30% per year right now. So Mexico's oil production is just falling like a stone. You know, this puts more pressure on the few countries that are left that are able to increase production, which are basically all OPEC countries. Brazil plus OPEC are the only countries that are actually able to maintain or increase production at this point. So world oil production will probably peak out within the next 2 years or so. And that will be an enormous economic challenge for the rest of the world, particularly the United States, because we're so dependent on oil, and we're especially dependent on having cheap oil and having more of it available with every passing year. So that's the main reason that we saw the big price run-up in oil this year and gasoline, where oil went from, 10 years ago, oil was selling for $12 a barrel, and this year it went up to almost $150 a barrel. And it's back down to about $100 now, but that's only because of the terrible economic effects that we saw from high oil prices, and that's going to get worse. We've seen the near collapse of the airline industry. Truckers have gone bankrupt. It's hurting farmers. All of these things are going to get much, much worse as time goes on as a result of very expensive oil.
Yeah, I don't think that most people seem to understand that oil is something besides something that we use in our cars. They think of it in terms of transportation, and that's about the end of it. Would you like to expand on effects, Richard?
Yeah, we've created a world that's really oil dependent in a thousand different ways. We use it for producing plastics and chemicals and really the one thing that worries me the most is the food system, because for every calorie of food we produce, we invest about 10 calories of fossil fuel energy in fertilizers, which we make actually from natural gas primarily, but also pesticides, herbicides, and the transport of farm inputs and outputs. Typical food items travel anywhere from dozens to hundreds of miles, and even by air. And of course, air transport is something that has no alternative. I mean, with cars, we can imagine running them on batteries. We have hybrid cars. We will have electric cars in the future. That's not going to work for 18-wheelers. I suppose we could run those on biodiesel, but running airplanes is going to be a big problem. And I've had discussions with folks from Boeing and NASA and World Bank and other places about the air transport industry, and nobody has any good ideas. Sir Richard Branson of Virgin Atlantic is talking about running his planes on some kind of advanced biofuel, but so far that's just an idea. And, of course, if they're able to do that, it's going to be very, very expensive fuel, and in any case, we'll be seeing a dramatic change in the airline industry. So that's the reason I'm talking about the airline industry. It's not just a matter of, you know, going to visit Aunt Martha once a year, you know, who lives in Boston. We use air transport for all kinds of things. It's for transporting food, computer parts. You know, it's really become an integral part of our lives.
Yeah, and the importance of food can't be stressed enough. And people don't often get the connections about the transportation. I hear even in Oregon, which is such an agricultural state, something like 2% of the food is local food. So I tell everybody, grow food, grow food, grow food.
Right. Our food system will become more relocalized, just as everything else will. We will start manufacturing more of our stuff here rather than buying it in China. But the problem is there's a time lag with all of this. You know, you can't change out your entire industrial system overnight just because suddenly fuel's getting more expensive. It takes decades to do something like that. So what we really need to do is start the process of relocalization before the most dramatic effects of peak oil become obvious. And unfortunately, we've waited much too long, and we have almost no lead time left. So the urgency is really acute.
I guess we really wasted the last 8 years then, haven't we?
Well, you could argue that we've wasted the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. Jimmy mm-hmm. Carter was talking about this problem back in the 1970s.
That's true, yes.
And, of course, it seemed too early to be worrying about it back then, because we were able to go out in the 70s and 80s and find new oil in the Gulf of Mexico, in Alaska, in the North Sea. And we had very cheap oil in the 1980s and 90s. So it seemed as though Jimmy Carter had been proved wrong. And, of course, now people want to do the same thing and go out and find oil in Alaska mm-hmm. and along the continental shelf. But now we're really looking at the very dregs of America's oil. We have produced over 90% of the oil that we will ever find and produce in the United States. And what's mm-hmm. left are just a few little patches that the oil industry itself is not particularly interested in, because they're in such difficult places to operate. So we're not going to have a rerun of the 1980s with the North Sea oil and and the Gulf of Mexico oil, bringing prices back down.
We've got about 1 minute before our little pledge break. Can you quickly tell us, a listener asked, does 60% of our oil come from Canada, and how is that, where is their peak?
Well, Canadian oil production is has been basically flat for the last few years. Their production of conventional oil is declining, and they're replacing that with unconventional oil from the tar sands in Alberta. And this is not really oil. It's bitumen, which is a solid stuff that has to be mined and then turned into a liquid fuel with a very energy-intensive process. So currently they're producing about 1.5 million barrels a day of synthetic oil from the tar sands. The U.S. imports about something like 13-14 million barrels a day. So that's only a it's more than a drop in the bucket, but it's about 10% of what we import.
We should talk about the energy invested and energy returned.
This is a somewhat arcane but extremely important subject. Basically, we have to invest energy to get energy. We have to expend energy to drill oil wells, to go out and find oil fields and drill the wells and then pump the oil and refine it. But it's a relatively trivial amount of energy compared to the energy we get back from the oil itself. And essentially, that's why we have a modern industrial world, is because we have such a high energy return on energy invested from high-quality fossil fuels. This is very different from the situation we had in pre-industrial times when we were getting our energy basically from secondhand sunlight. We were cutting down trees for wood and using wood for a fuel. We were also getting energy from growing crops and either eating the crops ourselves or feeding them to farm animals and then using oxen and horses to pull plows. That's how we were getting our energy before, and it took a lot of energy to get that little bit of energy that then we could use to keep everything else going. So you have to have an energy profit in order to run any kind of society at all, and the more your energy profit is as a percentage of the total energy that you're producing, the better off you're going to be, the more you're going to be able to have people doing things like, selling stocks and bonds as opposed to being out farming and cutting trees and doing basic productive work like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason this is important to consider is we're moving into a time where net energy has been at a very high level, historic high level, and it's declining. We're moving from the highest-grade fossil fuels to lower-grade fossil fuels. Earlier, we talked about the Canadian tar sands. Well, there's lots of Canadian tar sands up there in Alberta. There's billions and billions of potential barrels of oil there. But the problem is that it takes so much energy to mine the stuff and turn it into a liquid that the energy profit is pretty marginal. It's a low enough energy profit that, in fact, if that were our main energy source, we couldn't run an industrial society.
Boy, it also uses a lot of water and ruins the environment around it.
Absolutely. And this is true of other low-grade fossil fuels. As we deplete the high-grade, light sweet crude oil that we've been depending on, and as we deplete our natural gas reserves, increasingly we're going to be depending on coal, tar sands, heavy oil, shale oil, all of these things that require enormous amounts of not only energy inputs, but also water and other resources. It's going to be much more environmentally damaging. All of these sources produce lots more CO2, so the result will be a climate change Armageddon. So the only solution to all of this is to get off of fossil fuels. We know we have to do that in principle anyway, because these fuels are all finite and depleting. So we will be fossil fuel free in 100 years, no matter what we do. The question is, will we still have a habitable world? Mm-hmm. At that point,
would this concept apply to war? I mean, like, war uses up a lot of oil too.
Yes, but unfortunately, war doesn't use oil up fast enough to keep us from fighting them. And increasingly, we're fighting wars to control oil. And just to mention something, a few days ago we had the first presidential debate with Barack Obama and John McCain, and John McCain let something slip in the course of his comments, and he went off script a little bit, and he mentioned that Russia's interest in Georgia was not just controlling this little country, it was gaining control of oil pipelines. You know, when we talk about international affairs in this country, we're supposed to divide countries into good guys and bad guys. And we're not supposed to talk about the fact that the U.S. is actually in competition for essential resources like oil, because that adds a different dimension to the whole discussion. And suddenly, it's not that the Russians are bad guys, it's just that they're wanting to control the same stuff we are. And so maybe, you know, we may have to go fight a war with them as a result of that. Well, people don't want to go fighting wars just because, you know, we happen to be dependent on non-renewable resources. They want to fight wars because the other people are evil people. So he went off script there, unfortunately. I think it's going to cost him.
Richard Heinberg, I know that you travel around the world giving speeches, and you're with the Post Carbon Institute, and I'm wondering, you were on the front lines of alerting us to this issue of peak oil, and I find people are still in so much denial, but I'm just in my little, stay in one place.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if you're finding people are waking up, or if you could give some, if you would give some impressions of what you've noticed in your travels.
Well, I would say over the course of the past 10 years that I've been talking about this issue, there has been an enormous shift, but most of that shift has happened just within the last 2 years as a result of skyrocketing oil prices. Nothing wakes people up to this issue like seeing gasoline go from $2 a gallon to $4 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only, you know, ordinary people who are having trouble filling up their gas tanks. It's also economists, people in the media. These days I am having discussions with high-level folks, and I've spoken at state houses all around the country. I've spoken with members of parliament in all the English-speaking countries, and even 3 or 4 years ago, this discussion was just not even taken seriously. I mean, climate change was something that folks would talk about, but problem of oil depletion was most people thought it was something that was far, far in the future, and we really wouldn't have to deal with that because by the time we got there, we'd have alternative sources of energy. Now I see worried faces just about everywhere I go. City councils, county boards of supervisors, all up and down the political spectrum, people are really concerned because they see the economic damage that high oil prices bring, and they know that they don't have any plan in place. Right now, there are gasoline shortages throughout the southeast of this country. In Atlanta, Georgia, two-thirds to three-quarters of the gas stations are closed. This is a lingering result of Hurricane Ike. We're not hearing about it in the rest of the country, and the reason for that is that the news media has looked at this, and they've been advised by the U.S. Department of Energy that it's better not to talk about it, because if they do, people will run out and top off their gasoline tanks, and that will drain the system. Well, I don't want people to do that. I don't want to drain the system, but I think we do need to understand how fragile our system of supply and delivery of fossil fuels really is. If just a couple of hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico can bring us to the brink of literally running out of gas nationally, then what kind of transport system do we have?
Yeah, really. Is this a good time to talk about oil depletion protocol?
Sure. Yeah, well, this is a simple agreement, it's not an idea that I came up with. A number of people have had this idea independently. It's a simple agreement to reduce our reliance on oil. use about 2.5% less voluntarily on an annual basis. And what this would do would reduce the pressure for higher prices. It would reduce the competition for remaining supplies, hopefully on a global level. Now, we know this would work because reduction in demand is basically what has reduced the price of oil just in the last 6 weeks. We were seeing oil trading at $150 a barrel almost, and now it's back down to about $100 a barrel. And the reason for the collapse in price was the fall in demand. We saw American drivers cutting back because they couldn't afford to fill up their big SUVs. We saw truckers going out of business, airlines grounding planes. And so as a result, the U.S. is actually using about 3% less gasoline today than it was a year ago. Well, that reduced demand has also reduced the price of oil. Well, if we were to do that continuously on an annual basis, reduce our demand for oil, that would keep the price affordable to those who really need the stuff as we continue the transition. And it would also reduce the need to go out and compete with other countries for access to the dwindling supply.
Are you noticing that there are programs for dealing with these issues in other countries or other parts?
We are seeing this oil depletion protocol. And by the way, I did write a book on the subject, so if mm-hmm. folks want to know more about the oil depletion protocol, they can get a book by that title, The Oil Depletion Protocol, and find out much more. But city councils across the country are starting to adopt the oil depletion protocol, at least in principle, in some cases, as a matter of policy. Oakland, California, San Francisco, Portland, there in Oregon, has adopted the oil depletion protocol. And we are seeing countries starting to understand how their dependence on oil is an enormous vulnerability. Sweden has decided to reduce its oil consumption to zero by the year 2020. And other countries are starting to take similar steps. This problem has to be approached at all levels. We have to get off of fossil fuels. That's the essential realization that has to sink in at every level of society, from the federal government all the way down to individuals. So that means, reorganizing our lives so that we are using less energy, because most of the energy that we're using right now comes from fossil fuels. Over 85%, almost 90% of the energy we use in the United States comes from oil, natural gas, or coal. So that means driving less. It means using public transportation. It means eating food that's grown locally, and it means eating organic food that's not produced with petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides. And it means looking at our homes, super insulating our homes so that we're using less heating fuel. These kinds of efforts take time, and they require some investment. My wife, Janet, and I have been at this for the past 10 years, working on our own home, and, I can tell you it's a work in progress. We have our solar panels on our roof and so on, but you can't just do this overnight, and for the country as a whole, it's going to be a long process. Instead of spending $700 billion bailing out the financial institutions, we should be spending that money on changing our energy infrastructure. And if we did that, we would have a much healthier economy, and we would have a foreign policy that doesn't, resort to force first and ask questions later.
Maybe we need to rethink what money is. Here in Portland, our TriMet has raised the bus fares, and they say the reason is that they have to pay more money for fuel. But if, money is, the dollar is kind of losing value, oil is gaining value. If they thought of oil as money, if they thought, what can we do to save oil rather than save money, they might say, well, we'll have free transit. Because we would get more oil back than otherwise.
Yeah, well, we need more public transit in the country, and that's what we should be investing in, because it does require investment. But the thing is, those investments pay off for decades, and they also create jobs. Whereas investments on Wall Street, you know, they may create paper wealth for a few people, but ultimately they actually harm the country.
And what we do with the remaining oil is should be carefully considered.
Right. And I should mention also that it's not just oil. We also are depending on natural gas and coal, and they also are draining away. I have a book on global coal supplies called Blackout that will be coming out in the spring, and it discusses global coal supplies. And there's, just to give you the quick summary, there's a lot less than we've been told, and in fact we're already seeing coal supply problems in China and India, and those are going to start spreading around the world.
Maybe that's a good thing, I don't know. Well, Richard, you're always pardon me,
in some ways it is, because of course coal is the worst of the fossil fuels in terms of carbon dioxide emissions and therefore climate change.
Well, I think we're near the end of our time. We've been talking to Richard Heinberg, who is the author of many books. The latest is Peak Everything, and who has been one of the biggest voices alerting people to this problem that we're in. And we want to really thank you for being with us. And do you have a website where we can catch up on your stuff?
Oh, sure. It's pretty simple, richardheinberg.com.
Well, that's real easy. Okay. Thank you very much for being with us. This has been Per Fogring.
And I'm Sue Supriano.